Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
You are now listening to the Thanks for Trying podcast, episode 5, with very special guests Maverick Sabre and Sinead Harnett. As always, the following recording of the Thanks for Trying podcast is unscripted, unadulterated, and recorded in my front room in East London with a bunch of my mates as some kind of audience. So of course, things get real sweary and probably a little bit offensive too. Shout out to Monte Alban Mezcal for sponsoring this month's episode. And big thank you, as always, to the show producer, Seb White. Enjoy. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to episode 5 of the Thanks for Trying podcast with myself, The Last Skeptic. And I'm very honoured to have two incredible singers as my special guests today, Sinead Harnett and Maverick Sabre.
Yes.
Sinead, when I last saw you, we were singing a very impassioned version of Since You've Been Gone to Kelly Clarkson.
We were.
And I don't
You were phenomenal.
Thanks.
You were so good, yeah. You came to watch me do a kind of slightly cringe corporate gig. But they were always a bit weird, aren't they? Because it's like...
Yeah.
It's just kind of a weird atmosphere. Not everyone's there for the music. Some people are just there for like the free drinks, so...
When there's an open bar, it's just, you know... That's definitely like, you know, the focus of all attention, especially for me. But, you know, clearly I have a problem. I'm guessing you do a lot of corporate gigs.
Yeah, the open bar can go one or two ways. It can either work in your favor or it can just distract people from what's going on in the stage. Most time it distracts people, and the little buffets distract people. And
absolutely, yeah, you know. Yeah.
Buffets are the most distracting thing in the world, man. I feel like I talked about this on the last podcast where, you know, I don't think I can concentrate on anything if there's free food available. It doesn't matter where I am or, you know, what's happening. You know, if there's free food, I've forgotten where I am.
100%.
I've just got to go in and make the most of that scenario in almost a military style fashion.
Next time you're at your bank machine, putting a bank card in, I'll offer you a free sandwich. And say, give us 50 quid, all right?
But how have you been? I haven't seen you in a long time.
Very well, yeah, very well, very well. Actually, I have seen you. I saw you in Finsbury Park underneath a bridge a couple of weeks ago.
I was very drunk.
I can't remember if I was drunk or not, but I probably was.
Your exact words were, "I've just come back from watching the football."
Oh, I probably was then. Yeah.
And,
okay.
And we were both really drunk.
Yeah, I've been keeping very well. Yeah, keeping well.
And you're writing, I'm guessing.
I'm writing at the minute. We were on a 2.5 month tour. We were in Australia, came back and did 6 weeks in England. Wow. And England, Ireland, and Wales actually. Yeah, and now we're back writing a third record and just writing in general for the summer. So,
wow.
So yeah, all's That's been mad. Good.
How was Oz?
Australia was beautiful. First time I was ever out there.
Really?
Yeah, we were out there supporting a hip hop group called Hilltop Hoods. Ooh. And it was their first arena tour out there. They're quite big. They've been going for years, if you're familiar with the Australian hip hop scene. And I was on two songs on their last record. So they invited me out there to do support and come on and perform the two songs during their set. And yeah, it was really...
They've got an amazing fan base, right?
Oh, amazing.
Like so dedicated.
Die hard.
Yeah.
You know, die hard. And it was, yeah, the guys are, you know, beautiful souls. It was brilliant to be able to go across the world and be able to perform like that. So yeah, it was beautiful. Really nice experience.
And what's, because I still haven't been to Australia, like what are the shows like out there? Like what's, you know, what's kind of the vibe?
Well, seeing as they're my first and only experiences out of them, I can only, you know, give my own experience. But their fans are like as dedicated as I've seen fans.
Yeah, same.
You know,
that's what I thought,
as dedicated as I've seen. They kind of reminded me of Irish fans in a way, where you know there's no boundaries to them. They're not watching each other. They're not judging each other when they're at the show. They're just enjoying it and giving it their full. You know, they've paid to come and see a show, and they're not holding back. Yeah. You know. They're not stushing anyway, or you know, looking at each other, and
not like London shows.
You know, no, not at all. They're really giving everything. Yeah. You know, they're there to give their all, and you really feel that passion and heart from them. Yeah, it was unbelievable, really.
Oh, sick. Have you been? Have you been out to us to do shows?
With Rudimental,
of course.
2013, I think, which feels like way too long ago.
They must have been brilliant shows out there. They've got quite a strong fan base.
Yeah, they flew up in Oz. Like, it's weird because America didn't really catch on to drum and bass, but. Yeah. Oz were just like so down for it, mate. Like they were just going in. Like
that's great. That was a great accent.
Fully dancing. Thanks. I do try with accents.
I'm looking forward to the rest of your repertoire of accents throughout the show.
It's so weird. I actually had to go through every accent I can do today. Like there was this massive list, like 100 accents.
What?
I was only allowed to choose 20.
And so. you shouldn't have said that, because you know we're going to have to put
yeah, exactly.
They better be up to par. Yeah.
Was this just a personal challenge? Were you just in your house and you had a list and you I've got to practice.
Do you know what? I've actually started, like I did acting at uni and I've started doing this workshop. Held by my friend Arjun, who said that you're his boy. He was like, oh, you see him
today?
Oh,
yeah, Arjun,
like,
right.
So he set that up and I was just doing my spotlight application.
Whoa.
So, like, there was such a variety of accents to choose from. So I just picked my top 20, really.
20 is quite a lot. I don't think I could do 20 accents.
I think you could.
What? I can't.
You're being modest.
I can do, like, I'm not going to do any of them until...
No, don't start bringing this up.
I'm not going to do
it.
I'm not going to do any.
This is going to go down a horrible route.
Yeah, it's going to go a terrible route.
So, Sinead, tell us, what accents were you able to do out of 20? Give us your 5 strongest, please.
You serious? Must have.
I'm dead serious. Yeah.
He's got a look of determination in his eyes.
See,
he's
you
good. Thank you. I appreciate it. Appreciate he's got my back.
Well, I've done Australian.
You've done. That was fairly convincing. So you got 4 more.
Sure, she can laugh, but can she do her own stunts? Scottish.
That's a good one.
That's a great. That's a really good German accent. It's really good.
All right. That's
wow. American's really easy. We're just gonna chill. I don't really know why, but I just want to chill and surf. I know.
Scottish.
That was American. So how many more? 2 more.
Two more.
All right, I do a really good re. Like, have you seen?
What was it? What?
It's Bayesian accent.
But she messes it up a bit with like American and when Chris Brown came over and he really. Broke my heart, and I won't do a final one because I feel a bit
under
too
pressure.
Much.
Don't worry,
okay, you did. So you did. How long did you tour Australia for?
3 weeks.
Wow.
I basically finished touring with them. The last thing I did was the Mobos, and then they were like, "Oh, please, can you come to Oz? We just need you to come." So I was like, "Of course, I'm going to go there."
Mad.
And that's where I actually like learned how to party.
Yeah.
They know how to party.
Yeah, they do.
Yeah.
I'm guessing just some mad shit occurs when you go on these, because I've only done kind of one major tour like that, and it's beautiful, but it wears you down.
Beautiful, yeah. Tour experiences are different experiences in their own, especially you know, being in a bus life and being with a specific group of people that you know go through the same experiences every day, and it's like you know, even going out and partying as part of the routine almost.
Yes.
You know
what I mean?
It's almost in the schedule for it, you
definitely.
Know. And you
it's
get
like
very...
You become part of a family.
And you get very attached to people.
Definitely.
You know?
And I remember before I actually joined tour with them, because I stayed on tour with them for 6 months, I was like living on my own, like quite regimented, like in terms of when I shut my door, it was like bye world. And then I was just suddenly like, waking up with fucking boys farting and stuff, and like just having to be like, oh yeah, that's just Leon, that's what he does. So it was good because it took me out of my comfort zone. So.
Yeah, and it's like a moving school. Your only experience it was like for me was being back at school, going on a really long school trip.
It's an adult school trip.
An adult school trip.
Where you get to do what you love every evening.
Exactly. So you're writing your new record right now as well.
Yeah.
Or it's finished.
Well, no. So I've just done a new EP, which I feel like it's the most me out of like anything that I've done.
Yeah.
I was thinking about this today, actually. I feel like maybe I wasn't ready to like to talk about what I've talked about in this.
Yeah.
I feel like when I listen back to the stuff that's out, it's like a little bit more surface than this EP. So I'm really excited to get that out.
Yeah.
Then I basically want to just do singles after that, like just one song kind of entities, and then hopefully from that I'll be able to put out an album. But you know, it's kind of suicide if you don't have a buzz to just drop an album. Although the Americans, I feel, make it look really easy, like Bryson Tiller, Kehlani. I feel like I didn't know them till I saw they had an album out.
Yeah.
And then
yeah.
It's like an organic growth.
I think that routine is kind of dying a bit, where you have to, you know, single and build up a buzz. And obviously a buzz is key, you know. A buzz can come in many different ways. But I think this, you know, this old 90s style of releasing music is kind of becoming a bit old hat now. And I quite like the idea of releasing a record and walking off the back of that record.
Same.
Definitely.
You know, because you've got a body of work to convince people of and to bring on the road and to test, because you know what it's like when you start on the road with a body of work, and by the end, you know, it can develop and can change, and you can, you know, you can accentuate certain parts of the songs and certain lyrics that you realize connect more with people along the time. So yeah, I think it's quite an interesting way of releasing music.
Yeah.
And also because no one really has the answer right now. Like no like,
there is no answer.
No fucking clue, like what to do.
Everyone's in the dark at the moment.
Exactly. Whether you do a bunch of singles that aren't on the album, whether you do the album, then you know that they don't really know how to work it anyway right now anyway. So I think it's a beautiful time to kind of just do the music that you love and then hope that they are not, I mean, as a, you know,
it feels like the divide is like way bigger, like the contrast of pop and just like credible. Not that pop isn't credible, but you know, like just stuff that's immediately hit worthy and clearly like they've gone into a room with someone that makes number ones, like or just has like top tens, and then there's just credible, like I don't know, James Blake or whatever, that his fans are dedicated, but maybe the sales aren't the same as the massive artist, but then maybe they don't have the fans. So it feels like it, you know what you said about you just have to make good music. Like that's what I found this year. How has any artist walked out of that, like to have to abandon just making good music? Like it shouldn't be that way. So I feel excited that I'm able to do that now, and I'd rather be doing that than the other thing, I think.
And do you still feel the pressure from all sides? Because you've got, you know, both of you have got pressure from label, from but also from a fan base, and, you know, to deliver something that I guess you don't know quite what it is until it comes out, right? Until...
Yeah, I suppose, look, you can take on as many people's opinions and as much pressure from as many people as you want to take on. But in the end of the day, I think the pressure all comes down to yourself and it is as much as you allow it to be.
Yeah.
You know, in the end of the day, it's your name on the music. It's your diary entry. It's your story. It's your expression. It's what it should be. It's your painting, you know. So in the end of the day, I always feel like we can get easily misguided with things and distracted. But if you, you know, come back to, I always think, if you come back to the 15-year-old self when you first started doing it, when it was the true passion, think, you know, what was I making then? And what was I happy to, you know, when you wrote your first song, you thought it was a banger, you loved it and was, you know, you were passionate about it. And what's happened since then, you know?
Yeah.
I think for me, as I've always tried, whenever I'm in times of, you know, a bit of a blurred vision, I try and remember back to that. What would my 15-year-old self tell myself now, you know?
It's tough to do that when you have like so many internal voices as well. Especially with my stuff, where I get swayed, where I'm like, oh, should I release more of a tune right now that I've got that's more grime because everyone wants me to do that, or more this because of that, when essentially I just want to make really emotional, cinematic, like hip hop. You know what I mean? Like really sad music, you know? And I'm like, well, will that resonate as much? I mean, to me, I mean, I'll die really happy knowing that I've released all the music that I fucking loved. But
yeah, I suppose, you know, doubt's the biggest enemy that we always battle with, really, you know? But we just have to go with our gut in the end of the day, or else we won't go with anything. And, you know, we'll be led down the path by someone else, and then it'll be us that we'll have to pick up the pieces because it's our name on it, you know?
Yeah, it's true.
Yeah.
And you used to rap as well. I mean, you still do.
That's why that's kind of where I started, really. Yeah. I was an MC on the Irish hip hop scene when I was. That's where I started, 14, 15, and I was in school, and because the Irish hip hop scene was quite small, we used to do like all the support acts with a group of DJs called Rap Ireland. Mm. And we used to do the support slots for like The Game, 50 Cent, G-Unit, Plan B when they first came over. That's how I met Plan B for the first time. Yeah. And yeah, that's where it started. That's where the kind of passion really started. I was songwriting before. My dad is a musician. And
What did your dad play?
My dad plays a lot of traditional Irish music and blues.
Amazing.
Never full time, but it was always in the house. Music was always in the house, live music. Yeah. In an Irish household, you know, live music is always quite strong, especially around my dad.
And do you ever just want to be a spitter?
Oh, I'm always a spitter.
Just always. Like
I'm always a spitter.
Going out there doing battles.
Yeah, I don't know about battles. It was always a written thing for me. hip hop's in my heart. Mm. I wouldn't be doing this if it wasn't for hip hop. I wouldn't be making or writing all my songs, even, you know, my most well-known songs. Were written from inspiration from hip hop.
You know? Yeah, I think that's the thing that, you know, what has united every single guest that I've had on this show, even though we haven't explicitly spoken about it in every single one, is that whoever it is that I've had on has just like had this deep rooted love for rap, and they've always come from that deep rooted love for rap. Even, you know, the first guest, Doc and Scryne, you know, they, no matter where they've taken their careers, they've just, it's all come from and all been informed by the confidence that was given to them by listening to Tupac or whoever, you know what I mean, as a kid. And like, do you find that, Sinead, as well, just from like listening to rap, it kind of gives you a little boost to like kind of go, you know what, even though I'm singing these songs, you know, I'm coming out here with, I've got DMX in my mind. That's how I'm doing it.
I mean, mine will probably be more like Lauryn Hill, but I definitely think, like, when I listen to Kendrick or someone that's kind of doing that movement now, I'm like, that's when I'm a straight up gangster, you know, when it's on in the car and like I'm rapping along and stuff. But I think it's a good way to, it actually inspires me with writing as well. Like sometimes, I don't know if you've heard that new Salaam Remy, Miguel and Kendrick record. I can't remember what it's called, but Salaam, you know, he's
Salaam Remy is the guy.
Yes. He's my ultimate. Yeah. Like that's how you and me started bonding, because we were talking about Salaam. And the beat, I haven't even listened to the song, because the piano beginning, I was like, I'm writing a tune, so I need to basically I don't want to divulge it. Yeah, I'm gonna cut it up, loop it and write to it, because I haven't even heard their bit yet. I heard Miguel like do one bit and I was like, no, I don't want to hear it. So like, I think they've just
my favorite
hip hop beats are, you can't steal the idea, by the way.
No, I won't.
But you could join
in.
I'm
gonna home and cut it.
Is that it, like, marries like this gangster dope swag with like just heart wrenching piano chords, or like just something that pulls on your heartstrings chords wise, whatever the instrument is. And that's, I actually, the first song that I wrote was to this Milkbone instrumental.
What, Where the Party At or something?
No, forgotten the name.
Why do I even know that? Probably like the only person in the world who knows who Milkbone is.
I don't know if I do. I just heard the music.
Whoa. Yeah. Help yourself to tequila, by the way. And you know what? I keep seeing that there's a worm at the bottom of this bottle of tequila, and it's...
Was the worm killed for the bottle, or did it die?
Of natural causes.
Meant to make you...
hallucinate.
Yeah.
What kind of conversation are you looking to get out of this?
You know what I mean? I mean, like, I really hope that the worm died, was alive, and then died in the bottle, because I feel like it wouldn't be such a bad place to go.
In a bottle of tequila, you know.
Have you eaten one of the worms before in tequila?
No, I haven't. I've tried the tequila before, but I'm more of a stout man myself. Even though this, what did you call it? It was a...
Oh, it was slow gin. So my friends of mine, Sonny, big up to Sonny Malhotra. He gave me these today and said, because he listens to the podcast, and he was like, can you thank me and say my name on the podcast for giving you the slow gin?
So thank you very much
thank
for this.
You.
Sonny Malhotra. Yeah, Lauren, went down very
congratulations
well.
On the wedding. And they had these, and on every table in the wedding, everyone had a little bottle of their homemade slow gin.
Yeah, that's nice.
And it's really good. I think they kind of like soak the slow berries in the gin or something.
Right. If you ever get married again, invite me, all right?
I love people that make their own booze like that. I feel I need to try moonshine one day.
Oh, most definitely, yeah.
Have you had moonshine before?
I've had poaching, which is like, I suppose, the Irish version of moonshine.
What's that made out of?
Don't ask me, I don't know what it's made out of, but it's very strong. It's like an absinthe, I suppose, type drink. Had it when I was younger, but...
Is it like paint stripper or like paint thinner kind of?
It's strong, yeah, it probably has the same effects, but yeah, it's strong enough, yeah.
When I lived in America about 10 years ago, I had a birthday party and this old... I lived with a punk band and I must have been like 20 years old, so I couldn't even drink. Washington, D.C.
Mm.
Yeah.
Sick.
The belly of the beast. And I was there and they had this party. The punk band I lived with had loads of old kind of punk rocker mates. And one of the guys they invited was this dude who must have been in quite a famous band out there, but I have no idea. I didn't know anything at the time about punk. And he brings this little Coke bottle. And right at the bottom, there's this tiny, it's not even an inch of clear liquid. And he goes, "Happy birthday, Corin. Bought you this moonshine that I made. Just so you know, last time I had a sip of this, I went blind for 6 hours. So go easy." I just kind of like took it, smelt it. Oh my God, I didn't fucking do it. I love booze, but that was...
You were scared.
I was frightened. Is it 20 year old?
Made out of?
No. Just keep on drinking until you're blind. I think that's probably going to be name my next record. Fuck me. Yeah. So I'm so excited to hear the new music, especially because you're saying your whole soul is in it. Like, this is...
Did I say
great.
That?
Well, it's pretty much, you know, yeah. I inferred it.
Yeah. Well, I think it's like the starting point for... I haven't released anything this year, so I honestly don't know what you're going to think.
And what kind of... So have you changed styles? Like, I'm so intrigued. Can I say who's produced the song?
Yeah.
You've got a beat from K Tronada.
Yeah, so I did two with him. Yeah, so yeah. The other one is on the EP.
Okay.
And then his the sample one, which has Wretches on it as well. Mm. That'll just come out after.
Yeah.
And then Grades did one of them, and he's the one that works with Neo a lot. And
Grades is wicked.
That was like probably the third session that I did since like the kind of big changeover I did last year, and I remember like it was the first time that I thought, oh, I can write. Yeah. Like, because I'd spent so long feeling like everything I was doing was wrong. So with him I was just like, it flowed, and I felt I was really proud of that song. So that's that one. That'll be the first release. Did the video for it yesterday.
Sick. I saw that.
Did you? Yeah,
just
yeah,
filming.
Yeah.
I wasn't standing in the corner watching you. Not this time. And so what was it like working with K-Tray?
Well, I didn't meet him. Well, I have met... Yeah. No, I haven't actually. I've just slid on his DMs a few times. You know, we started speaking on Twitter. He followed me because he tweeted something like, "We're the dope ass singers," like something like that. And my friend...
He sounds like Rihanna.
Does he? he obviously doesn't speak like that at all.
That was the fifth accent there. Yeah, K-Tronada, yeah. All right. K-Tronada. Locked it down.
Very specific. This is good.
Obviously, there was no accent either because it was typed. Yeah, and so he followed me, and then I was like, what? Like, wow.
Yeah.
Okay, follow back.
Waited a day.
So he just sent me like a file of like maybe 10 instrumentals, and then I wrote you a few of them.
Like,
he's lovely, yeah. He is very, very nice.
I can't wait to hear you singing on one of his beats. And what are you thinking vibes-wise for production on the new record? Are you going to...
At the moment, I'm just getting songs down.
Yeah.
Mm. So production
is that how you start usually? Just like kind of get the idea or lyrics wise.
Yeah, because you know I feel like for me every record needs to have not a theme, but I need to be at a certain stage and realize what I'm writing about. You know, I need to have, you know, been through a certain stage in my life where I need to kind of jot down points of what's inspired me, what's you know, gotten passion out of me, and what I really need to express and feel like I need to talk about. So at the minute, I'm just really in the stage of kind of getting the bare basics of the songs down, you know. And I've been on the road for the last, you know, 2.5 months, so that's given me a different inspiration. And I'm moving flat at the minute, so I'm in between flats. So at the moment, I'm just getting the basics down, and then I come back after with production and sit down and get the final touches to it then, you know.
Who are some of your dream producers to work with?
Well, I'm a big hip hop fan, so Pete Rock, Ninth Wonder's been I've always wanted to do something with Ninth. Salam Remy's always been someone that I'm just a big fan of everything he's done. Mark Ronson is someone I really value. Paul Epworth as well. I think, you know, everything he puts his hands to
for that big pop record.
Everything sounding. he gives a very cinematic feel to music.
Huge.
Whether it's Adele or Florence or whatever he touches, he just gives this certain sound to it, dynamic to it. That I really like.
Have you hit up like Pete Rock or anyone like that?
Yeah, I was talking to Ninth. About 2 years ago. We were supposed to do something when he came over to London. Never materialized in the end, but I would still like to try that angle, you know, because Ninth is someone I've always been really inspired by, especially doing my own production, you know.
Do you produce?
I produce. Yeah, I've been producing since I've been a kid. Yeah.
Oh, amazing.
A lot of hip hop stuff. That's my go to. You know, I wrote most of my choruses over the years over hip hop beats.
Sick.
You know, that's always been my inspiration. Hip hop beats is what, you know, what introduced me to jazz.
Yeah.
What was really that? You know, I knew more about jazz, not even realizing I was listening to jazz when I was a kid. You know, finding Ahmed Jamal and Miles Davis and, you know, knowing the tunes. You know, being around my band and. Then, you know, have you heard this Miles Davis tune? That I was like, wait, hold on.
Song.
3:20, I sampled this when I was 15, didn't know anything about jazz. Kind of going back to hip-hop again, it's another, you know, it's a circle all the time.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, of course. Well, to me, it was the education that I got.
Massive.
Such an education from hip-hop.
Massive.
Like, I wouldn't have known anything. Like, this, I mean, the arguments, I don't have the same arguments anymore as I did, as I'm sure you guys did, like, 10 years ago, 15 years ago, especially when I was in school and trying to talk to the older generation that would say into rock or into whatever, and they're like, well, you know, hip hop, I don't like hip hop, it's too this or it's too that, and I'm like, well, you don't know anything about rap, but I know everything about all of the genres that you like because rap encompasses all of it. But luckily everyone's a lot more open-minded now, but,
and it's an educational in the sense of historically educational as well, you know, especially I'm a big Tupac Shakur fan, for me I was always, you know, I was brought up, my parents always brought me up to know about society that we live in, inequalities, injustices, the history of our own history of Ireland, you know. So to hear people like Tupac and Talib Kweli and Mos Def speak, you know, it intrigued me because I was hearing struggles that I didn't know anything about, but I could connect them in certain ways of struggles that you know, I knew more historically about in our own sense of Ireland or European ways, you know.
Do you feel like, because that's actually a very important thing I wanted to talk to ask you about, is do you feel like music like that gave you the power almost to put to be political within music? Because a lot of people are not scared, but especially within rap, to kind of include politics within that, and now it's luckily changing, and you know, I've felt very happy and empowered by the fact that a lot of grime artists are coming out and being very political at the moment.
The novelists of the world,
so good. But you know, is it tough to do that, especially being attached to a major? Is there like is it difficult to kind of make it political?
Don't get me wrong, you fight new battles when you know your lyrics and your message is about something a bit deeper, and something that actually affects the general people, and it's not just, oh, forget about everything, you're in love, you're in a club, all right,
throw your hands up,
which, look, has its purpose, and don't get me wrong, I throw my hands up and I'm in the club. don't get me wrong, and it has its place, but there needs to be a balance, that's all I'm saying. Needs to be a balance, or else it's like, you know, you can have a little cheeseburger every now and then, so I'm vegetarian, so I'm not supporting any but you have to balance out. You got to give your kids an apple and, you know, banana and some fruit and veg sometimes. It has to be balanced. And if you're given, my opinion, if you're given watered down music that's desensitizing, you know, a generation, you know, and blinding them from the truth of actually what's going on, then you're not serving our youth, specifically where the music is aimed at. You know, there's a Nina Simone quote. I don't know if you've seen the documentary. Where's Nina Simone?
Oh, I need to see that.
Heartbreaking documentary.
Beautiful documentary.
So beautiful. Netflix.
Netflix, yeah. And she said something more along the lines of, you know, if this was definitely not the direct quote, I can already tell I've got it wrong, but you know, music's here to to speak about the times, you know. And if we're not using music as a tool, it doesn't need to be in every single song, because every single emotion isn't about the times, it's about personality, whatever. But if it's not, you know, educating people and speaking about the struggle of people in that time, then what are we doing it for?
Exactly. Yeah.
We're wasting it, you know. We're wasting it.
The voice.
We're wasting 3 minutes, 4 minutes in a kid's ears on the way to school, or in, you know, a husband's or wife or whoever it may be on the way to work in the morning or in the car home. And we've got that opportunity to be in someone. They're actually, they might listen to us more than they listen to their mother or their dad or their parents or their teacher. So why waste that time in someone's ear? You know, I'm not telling you need to say it in 1944, 6 o'clock. You don't need to give them every fact to make them feel, you know, overwhelmed. But I feel like we've got a duty. Sorry, that was it.
No,
she said we've got a duty. That was it. Sorry.
Right.
Yeah, we've got a duty. It's a responsibility of ours.
It's an education.
Yeah, we have to try and do as much as we can.
Yeah.
You know, I'm not saying everyone needs to be a historian by any means, but we need to try and do our best, because we've been given a great blessing, you know, and a great responsibility, and we have to try and do our best with it.
Yeah.
I think you hit a nail on a donkey when you said
that. That's definitely a phrase. That is definitely a phrase.
When you
donkey.
Yes. That old adage, hit the nail on the donkey.
When you said
no harm to any donkeys,
the donkey game on the wall.
Cord
as a kid.
Recording. All right.
No, you hit it when you said about the emotion, because I could literally all day try and come up with songs that are going to inspire the youth and like try and change the world. But if when you said emotion, if it is not authentic to me and I'm not actually something hasn't happened to inspire that, then I'm not just going to, you know, try and sound clever or whatever.
No,
but if it feels right, then, and I can, then I'm going to try and fulfill that duty as much as possible. And I think I can always feel when something's, we can feel when there's soul in something, when it's real, when the person's got their heart on the in the lyrics, you know. And I'd hope that I definitely, before I die, want to have a song that isn't just about my own personal like heartbreak or whatever, actually is about trying to promote something good happening. And you know, Leonardo DiCaprio never stands there like, I did a fantastic performance in what
number
was it?
Six, accent number six.
What was the big one that when he took the pill and he couldn't walk?
Titanic.
No. Oh, Wolf Street.
Wolf Street,
right?
That was a lovely explanation of the whole movie.
No, wait,
when he took a pill.
He took that pill. It was something like lemon. And
The Matrix.
That performance was so sick. Anyway, this has a meaning. I do go off on tangents.
No,
is
good.
That he doesn't stand there going, let me bathe in your soul, in your love of me. It's hey, we can do something about the way that we're treating this planet, like that. He'll spend all of that limelight doing that. And I don't know if you guys are familiar with Jerome Jarre, anyone? He is an absolute don, right? He became famous, that air quotes, by the way, because who gives a shit about that?
He became,
you know, well known because he did funny vines, you know, alleviating people of their pain by just being funny. And suddenly he's massive, and now his Instagram is all about is about helping people and about all the bullshit that's happening in the world. And it's like, but he also lightens everyone's hearts because he's funny. So it's like, it's important, I think.
It's good to have it, like a mixture of two. But I think you're totally right. You hit the nail on the donkey in saying that, you know, it has to be authentic, like 100%.
Most definitely.
And it has to be how you feel. And if it's, you know, like it's not something that you're fully behind yet, or you haven't quite worked out how to put it into words just in that at that point, then there's no point doing it, in a sense, you know.
No, of course, I think you did hit the nail on the donkey by saying it's got to be true to your emotion. But I even think, you know, it being personal can still change the world. It doesn't.
Exactly.
Of course.
Did you say porcelain?
No.
Being porcelain.
Sorry, my accent's getting in the way. I'm one kind of Guinness down. Yeah. What's in this slow gin?
No, I should understand you. My granddad literally spoke exactly the same.
I've been let down now. We're going to expect an Irish accent from you in 5 minutes. No.
Ultra.
Oh, Lord.
Oh, no.
Oi, okay. Do you know what?
Oh, no.
Literally, I'm Irish and I can't do an Irish accent.
Don't worry, we'll get it to you at the end.
Anyway, what were you saying about porcelain?
I think you're about porcelain, yeah. No,
he's so porcelain.
I think you're right about it being a record or music that you write being personal. You know, it can be whether it's
Oi, you ain't hitting my donkey with that word. I don't understand.
You keep your nail away from my donkey.
Personal. Thank you very much.
Oh my!
And you've got an Irish grandfather.
Oh my gosh, I thought you said porcelain, and then I thought you said porcelain.
I just broke into a little Gaelic for a while there, that's what it was.
Sorry, porpoise. Babe, I love your accent. Personal, sorry.
We'll get
say
down.
It again, say it again.
Personal.
Oh my
God. Personal, you got that now?
That is incredible.
I'm going to have to, have you got a little pen and pad?
Yeah, that's it.
Sorry, yeah, as long as, as long as it's personal.
This is just taking up whole seriousness at a point away.
This is great.
Language, accent barriers.
Yeah, don't worry. Yeah. I'm going to have to do what Conor McGregor does and put a pencil in his mouth to train himself to articulate better. But if it's personal, right?
Yep. Yeah.
And even it's about, you know, heartbreak or doubt within what you're experiencing or depression within your own life, it doesn't need to be about worldly issues. That is a worldly issue because everybody from every walk of life goes through that, you know. So you're definitely right, man. It, as long as it's authentic, it needs to be, you know, and it needs to feel authentic. And I think once it is authentic, that's the universal language, authenticity, really, you know.
Definitely. Can you say the word worsen?
Worsen.
Okay.
That's not
so
bad,
basically, your O's are or and mine or. Are
Yeah, okay. That's
personal.
Yeah, Warson.
Okay, thanks.
Okay, great.
This is lovely. Axel number six, perfecting.
Yeah.
Trying to perfect it down.
I would train in... Are you northern Irish?
No.
Southern?
No, southern. Whereabouts? County Wexford. Right at the southeast.
Is that anywhere near Limerick?
Limerick is in the west coast.
I'm from Limerick.
Oh, you're from Limerick?
Yeah.
Oh, right.
But I obviously don't have geography as a degree.
Okay, all right. Well, yeah. So what, your grandfather's from Limerick?
Yeah.
I love the Limerick accent. That's a lot stronger. Well, I've been here for so long. I was born here but raised in Ireland, so my accent's all over the place, really.
But. So you're North London through and through, right?
Well, yeah. I was born in Stoke Newington. My mum's from Stoke Newington. Her dad's Irish and my father is Irish. And I was born in Stoke Newington, but when I was 4, I moved over to Ireland and came back when I was 17, 18. Mm. And I've been kind of back here ever since, really.
Because I knew you were about these sides and like Finsbury Parkways and all that for a while. And obviously I've been like born and raised Finsbury Park and hence the Arsenal connection.
Of course.
But we're not allowed to talk about football.
No, that's it.
Not allowed to talk about football.
Only touch on football we do.
would you ever move back? Or would you ever like, you know, how do you feel about...
What, would I ever move back to Finsbury Park?
The motherland of Finsbury Park.
Oh, Finsbury Park, the days...
So I wanted you. So you worked with Joey Badass. How do you say it?
Badass.
I say badass. No. Joey Badass.
Badass.
Yeah.
Because you know, I've obviously listened to Joey for a long time. You know, I've loved everything he's done. And how is it working with him? He's incredible.
Yeah, great. I've known Joey for a couple of years. We kind of connected because a friend of mine put me on to. The 1999 mixtape.
Yeah, incredible.
And he used a couple of Lewis Parker beats.
Yeah, of course.
And that's I'm a big Lewis Parker fan, you know, UK hip hop.
Yeah.
And I'd actually over one, I think it was Fragments of a Thousand, or a Thousand Fragments or something, was one of the beats that he used.
Right.
And I'd written a piece over it like a month beforehand or something like that, and I heard the record and I thought, all right, I need to get in contact with him. Never did. And then he posted up the lyrics to one of my songs I Need on his on his Twitter, and we just got in contact. And it was when he was 17, first time he came over to London was, I think he was 18, and I'd done a remix for a song of his, and we met each other on stage at the 100 Club. And built a relationship from there and just became like very brotherly from there. And
it seems very natural. Whenever I've seen you guys together or doing songs, it seems like you're actually boys.
It's family.
You know,
it's family. You know, and we've, you know, I've been on his album, he was on mine. We've done work. We're going to continue to do work. And it's You know, like you meet people through music, and sometimes it's, you know, musical relationships, and sometimes it's so much more than that. It's a brotherly love, you know. So
and it makes the process so much better.
Yeah,
like if you get on with someone, you know, like to have them in your space, or especially like you know, it's a very emotional process making records.
Oh, most definitely.
And so to feel open enough to collaborate with someone is, you know, it's a beautiful thing, a very important thing. I can't work with people that I don't like.
Of course, it's like
ever,
you know, creating a baby with someone in a sense, you know. But I think it has to be as natural as possible. Just when you get the best music.
Yeah. And would you do a collaborative album together?
I would. We've spoken.
Yeah.
My dream is to do me, Joey, and Chronix.
Sick.
That's the trio. That
it's Chronix record on your new record. That's a sick record.
And that's another similar relationship as well, kind of built up in the exact same way. He came over to London and we connected the first time, and I've been over Jamaica taking care of me when I've been over there, and yeah, it's been just kind of family love, you know.
Sick. And how much time have you spent in Jamaica, and have you recorded out there as well?
Yeah, I've recorded out there. I've recorded some pieces out there on the on the last album, and since I've been 18, I've been, you know, back and forth there about, you know, 5, 6, 7 times. So it's been nice. I've got a real love for Jamaica, man.
I really want to go to Jamaica.
It's a beautiful place. Really beautiful place, man. Very inspirational, man. There's a lovely spirit there.
Beautiful weather at all times.
Yeah, I know. I do want
to this
January London weather.
Oh man, here, like from November till about
June,
March. Yeah, June. Well, apparently July, because it's still raining now. But it's just dark and grey. Like, it's sad. I'll definitely want to be away this Christmas/ all of January, please.
I've been considering it. I'm just looking forward to the day that I can afford a summer home somewhere else, and then just go leave England for maybe 12 months of the year.
Come back for a week.
Yeah, come back for a week.
Drop an album and go back.
See my mum for Christmas.
Yeah.
Because, you know, Christmas is not the same if you spend it somewhere else.
I've never spent a Christmas in warm weather, so I think it would be quite weird spending a Christmas.
I think Christmas is weird, though, anyway.
Yeah.
Like, it's just, I don't know. I like being away for Christmas. I was in Vietnam like 2 years ago traveling, and we went down to the bottom where it was actually hot. The rest of it was freezing that time of year. And like, we just had Christmas hats on and we were swimming. It was sick.
That's a nice contrast. I'm sure it was
such
a really nice experience.
Yeah.
I did that in Thailand 1 year, and my ex-girlfriend at the time, and we just went like snorkeling on Christmas Day and then had pad thai for Christmas dinner. And I was like, this is amazing. Yeah, I'm getting sun. But at the same time,
did you miss the spuds?
I missed the spuds, you know.
Yeah, man.
They'll always draw you back. They'll always reel you back in. Like,
they bring you in roast potatoes.
Half a pound of butter just thrown on one potato.
Oh, yes.
Especially as my family's all vegetarian.
Oh, right.
Yeah.
Why are you both... Are you veggie as well?
I was vegetarian for 27 years. I grew up vegetarian.
Who made you cave?
27 years fully, not touching.
Fully, yeah, I'd never tried meat
from
in my
birth.
Life from birth, and then 27, so 1 year ago. about 3 years ago, I just I started eating meat. I guess a lot of people like to take claim to who made me eat meat, you know, like Big Lewis, Big Up Lewis Richards, Burger Gang. He was kind of like, well, he was like, you know, well, you started hanging out with us and then we started eating burgers, all right? You know, a lot of people are like, yeah, you know, you had your first steak with meat. And I'm like, no, well, to be honest, I didn't have any cultural reference for a lot of stuff. So did you recently turn veggie?
Yeah, in the last 3 years.
So you knew what a hamburger tastes like. You knew what bacon.
I grew up in Ireland.
Exactly.
Like, it was meat and two veg was the normal dish. Like, I went back to Ireland not eating veg, and they were like, "You spent too long in London. What are you doing over there?" Like, you know what I mean? Still, some of my Irish lads now are like, "What are you at?" Like, just totally baffled altogether. But yeah, it was about 3 years ago.
What made you quit?
Well, it was in stages. 3 years ago, an ex of mine was veggie. And she used to cook ridiculously good veggie meals and would always kind of drill this thing that I'd never really thought about, you know. I'd never really crossed my mind, to be honest. And it may sound a bit cliche, but I was on a beach in Thailand in January, went there for a holiday after Christmas. And I was sat on the beach eating a bacon sandwich one morning by myself. Mm. Right? Bacon sandwich, lovely
Christmas
white bread.
Christmas Day?
No. It was January. Yeah. Christmas Day.
January, sorry.
Getting the calling back for potatoes.
Yeah, exactly, of course.
And I just saw, I saw this beautiful scenery in front of me. You could hear the birds going, and it was a beautiful scene in front of me. And I'm sat here eating a bacon sandwich, and I just thought, this doesn't add up. Yeah. Somewhere in my gut, it doesn't add up. So I just, that was the last bit of meat I ever ate.
That is so weird.
That was the last bit of meat I ever get. Yeah, and then
You were like, everything here is authentic except this bacon.
Yeah, everything here is so natural. And I think at that point, it was a real turning point in me growing, and a turning point in my life of me realizing a lot of things about myself and the world around me, really. And it had a real moment for me. Yeah, you know. And then a year later, I was still eating chicken. A year later, gave up chicken, and then about 4 or 5 weeks ago I gave up fish.
Wow, so it's quite recent.
It was staggered. Yeah. It wasn't all in one go.
That's cool.
But yeah, it was staggered.
And fish, is it ethical reasons?
It's ethical, yeah. It's ethical. It was started off being ethical reasons and always was ethical reasons and still is. But then obviously once I got into that way of thinking, it opened up my mind to realize, you know, the other negatives, you know, environmental, you know, internally, and you know, just kind of all added up and didn't agree with how I was feeling anymore.
Okay.
Yeah. I fully agree. I grew up as a veggie with my parents where, like, my vibe was, there's so much to eat in the world that I don't have to kill anything to eat it, and you know, I'm sure it's the same. And the only reason I started was, I guess, purely like I was saying, because I had no idea what everyone was talking about. You know, this was back in the day when I was growing up. If you went to a McDonald's kids party, there was no veggie burger.
That must have been tough for you.
I was going in and getting a bun with a slice of cheese.
Oh. Chips again, is it? Yeah?
I couldn't even eat the chips because they fried it in beef fat at the time. Oh, so I was like this kid, 6-year-old, going, fuck, man. I ain't eating anything.
And you didn't eat fish?
And I didn't eat fish. So, like, I just had no understanding of just... I wanted to know what bacon tastes like. I wanted to know, that steak's good, cool, I know what you mean. I know what a steak is. And then I kind of just wanted to change my diet a lot and stop eating as much bread and carbs and all this stuff, and I ended up just becoming a real meaty dude. That's just because I was making up for almost lost
time. Did
you
notice any difference?
No, to be honest. Like, a lot of people say, oh, you know, you get more energy, and I think it's bullshit. Cows get their energy from grass, and I was never a preacher about it. I always listen, this is what I do, this is my choice, I'm a vegetarian and I back it fully. And I was almost a vegan too, pretty much. But I found the biggest argument was always with meat eaters that were so offended by me being vegetarian. And I don't know if you'll find this now.
I never realized that until I actually became vegetarian. Yeah. And it showed up a couple of people to me. I'm like, why are you so offended? And especially because I'm not, you know, I don't feel like I am anyway, like a preachy person in that sense where I'd be like, well, what are you doing eating meat over there? You know what I mean? I'm not, everyone's got their own. Yeah. Like, we all have our own paths in life. I believe what I believe, and I'll tell you what I believe if you ask, or I'll tell you, you know, my thoughts on it, but I won't judge you on it.
I won't stop you from doing it.
No. I used to eat it, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
You know, so it doesn't really make a difference to me. I'm not going to have a judgment of you from that. But you do find people come out of the woodwork and are actually offended. And I think, I don't know what the kind of basis comes from, but it's almost like, you know, maybe a defense mechanism.
Oh, big time.
Why are you so opposed to me having just my view? It's what I want to put in my body. Like, well, you don't know.
Yeah.
You don't know. Well, it's ridiculous.
But it's natural. It's natural to eat meat.
You need it. You need it for the protein. You need it for the... Well, no, you don't really.
Listen, I was a fat cunt since I was 13 years old, all right? I did not need meat to make me a fat cunt, all right? That was it. I had chickpeas, baby.
Yeah, there you go. I had a Nando's Black Card for 2 years, so I ate enough chicken for the whole of England. You know what I mean? Twice over, so I was all right. But it's funny that, you know, you get a certain section of people that get quite offended when you say... Yeah.
And people get well offended if you don't drink.
Yeah.
Yeah,
like,
that,
on
yeah,
nights
yeah.
out.
Yeah.
Like, and that's also the same kind of defensiveness, though, as well. Mm. That's like, well, I want to make myself feel better because I
need 14 pints. But I've got, I'm a big drinker myself, but I really, you probably do as well. Like, I really appreciate when I see someone, you know, I know I've got a couple of friends that can go out and literally they don't have much sugar in the diet, they don't drink, so they can go out and have a can or two of Coke, Coca-Cola, like, and really enjoy their night and be buzzing and dancing more than I am. I'm up against the wall, like, doing my little Irish skank in the corner, just keeping myself to myself. And they're buzzing and really enjoying the night. I've got to give it to them, you know, because I need a couple of drinks to go out and enjoy myself.
If I don't, like, my friends will look at me like I've just run over their cat. I'm like...
Are you not a big drinker then?
No. Basically, I'm one or the other.
Yeah.
I'm like... okay. I'm like... asleep under the table, or I'm not drinking that night. Like, I just, so if I'm having a sensible night, that's probably why I get a dirty look as well, because they know that I'm really fun when I'm drunk. But
you're really fun when you don't drink.
But can you go out, like, say if it's a club situation, can you go out and not drink and still enjoy it?
Yeah, definitely. But the music has to be good, and
the company has to be good.
The company has to be good. Yeah, and I might not stay all night. I might not stay as long.
And so you've recently had this time where you're not drinking as much as well recently.
It's never planned. But I'm going to Ibiza on Friday, so
I'm going to Ibiza on Sunday. So
I'm going to be there. I'm going for my
birthday. No, I'm going for my birthday.
Oh my gosh, happy birthday! Give me a little slide in my DMs. Tell me what I've gone.
I won't be eating meat, but I will be drinking a hell of a lot here. Yeah. So
are you performing in Ibiza?
No, not this year.
So you're just going for a rave.
I'm just going with my friends because I don't normally allow myself holidays, like, because I feel such terrible guilt, like. Yeah. I should be doing something productive, you know, but...
I find it, you know what, it's funny that you say that. I find it so tough to have an actual holiday. You know what I mean? Like, to go, I'm booking this time to go somewhere. Yeah. I was like, no, if I've got a gig, I'll book a gig. I'm going to this amazing place, but I'll just book a gig in somewhere there as well, you know?
I suppose it's tough because what we do is a bit all over the place. And sometimes, I know what you mean, you feel a tiny bit of guilt sometimes.
Yeah.
Like, you're like on the plane away to go away for a week or something. Mm. You're like, actually, I could be doing this. Or you listen to a song, you're like, actually, I should have been back in the studio. Yeah. What am I doing? Waste my time. And it is hard, but you just have to try and enjoy yourself as much as you can.
Definitely.
You know, once a year I do... I go to this retreat, meditation retreat in Devon.
Yeah.
Oh, wow. Yeah, and did I see you just before? Yeah, I did, that's right. And I do it once a year, and it's 7 days in the middle of nowhere, and you just no phone, no laptop, no anything, and it's the only time that I actually, like, have a mental holiday.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just meditation, like, 3 times a day. Half of it is in silence. It's no talking to anyone. It's fucking wonderful.
Wow.
And it's the only time I read a book. You know, the whole year I don't read anything the whole year because I've just got too much shit in my mind. And then that is how I go through 2 a week, because I'm just sitting there walking through the woods, like, do what you know what I mean. And that's
beautiful.
What's it like having silence for 7 days?
Well, this one is only like half in silence, so it's silent from 9 p.m. till 9 a.m. and then through the 3 meditations in between, and then on Wednesday is an entirely silent day. So it's, and you can choose to not talk to other people if you want to, but it's really nice. Like, on that Wednesday of the whole day of silence, you know, I mean, there's stuff in your head that becomes louder that you didn't know was there, which is sometimes scary, but also just really enlightening, you know. And what I found that the most amazing part of it was that the songs that I'd listened to on the train before I turned my phone off, I could replay them in my head. Like, I could mute layers, I could listen to a snare drum on repeat, I could loop it, I could listen to every single instrument in that song, because there was no music for a week.
Yeah.
So I was just like, my brain was working over, you know, overtime, and like analyzing different songs, and it was and it made the music that I made when I came back, like, you know, to me, so incredible, because I could, you know, had all of this, like, space in my head to kind of work, you know.
Mm.
And you don't get that space here. You don't get that space in London, especially.
And it probably, rather than walking overtime, it probably is back to walking the way our brain should be walking without all the distraction. And I suppose in that time, especially when you're in silence, does it make you confront things, voices, or, you know, stuff?
Big time. Yeah, big time. Because, you know, we rely on so much to get us through a day, and not necessarily in a manic depressive way, but just also just in a day-to-day basis. You know, I might, like, go, oh, I've got a big day tomorrow, I might take a Valium or a Nightol tonight, just to make sure, you know, or whatever. I might I don't know, just treat myself to a whiskey tonight and that'll sort me out. And in there, there's none of that. You can't take anything with you like that. And because you don't have your phone, especially before bed, you know, on your phone all the time.
Yeah.
You don't have these crutches or like safety blankets, you know, whatever you have as a kid, you know, not safety blankets, you know what I'm talking about.
Yeah.
And it's a real scary thing for the first few days. Cause you're like, what the fuck do I do? It's 9 PM. It's lights out. There's no one to talk to because it's all silence. Yeah. And then they're just going like twiddling my thumbs going, it's cool though. It's really enlightening.
Yeah.
Obviously they say that like a busy mind is less likely, is less likely to naturally fall into depression, right?
Mm.
Whereas if you've got all the time and the silence and no human interaction, it's much easier. So you're saying it was good, but it's scary. Mm. So is it because you feel like you confront what maybe is always brushed under a carpet?
Yeah, definitely. Like that's part of the reason why I'd find it. There's another one called Vipassana, which is, I think it's 12 days? No, 10 days of complete silence. And that is like, there's nothing. You can't talk to anyone. You can't look at anyone. And you can't laugh. Like, all of this stuff. And it's just fully... I mean, it's supposed to be incredible, but you get to, like, 4 days in, and people are, like, bawling their eyes out. You know, you just... You know, a friend of mine, she said she did one in India. And because you can't... There's no music and no sound. She ran into the woods one day. This was about 7 days in. And she found a little stick that like had something in it, and so when she shook it, it made a little shaking sound. So she stood there by a tree, like looking both ways, like thinking she was, you know, it like fucking a criminal or something. And she put it to her ears, shaking it, and she said that the sound was like she was having an orgasm. Like, it was so powerful after 7 days of that, you know, stimulation.
What was it?
It was just like a little stick, just with like that made a shaking sound. Crazy. So you think because all of your senses are just totally heightened because there's nothing there. There's not even cars in the street or sirens. Yeah. Like, I grew up in Finsbury Park. I'm used to noise all times.
Yeah. Mm.
So it's really, it's a very, very scary thing. Yeah. And I imagine if you did that, whoever you are, if you did that 10-day fully silent, you know, the demons that come up are insane. You know, I heard a story of a guy that he does like UFC fighting or like cage fighting in somewhere in Europe. And every time he finishes a competition, he gets on his motorbike and he drives back to England, and then he goes to Vipassana for 10 days before he comes back to his family, because he kind of like decompresses, goes into this like mad silence of thinking and getting it all out, all of this like the anger, or you know, all of the maybe the guilt he feels about like beating someone half to death every night. Yeah. And then, you know, fully just then goes back to his family and, you know, feeling different.
Oh wow.
Yeah. Anyway,
sounds like a very cleansing experience. Yeah. Lou,
are you into meditation?
I'm into the idea of it, but I've practiced it you know, a handful of times, but I've never properly got into it myself, in the sense of silence and being within myself in silence. I always find my meditation, I don't know, comes from something else. Music is a bit of my meditation.
Exercise.
I've got a bicycle in it, so that I kind of meditate when I go through the park on my bike and up Alexandra Palace and stuff like that.
Should join bike gang, man.
Yeah, I should too. Yeah.
So I got a little.
Do they
little
join gang up with the Burger Gang and meet on Saturday evenings at Finsbury Park?
Burger Gang, bike gang.
Yeah. It's something that I've, because a lot of people around me always, you know, really trying to push me into it, and it's something that I'd really like to try. I've never really just given it the experience myself, you know.
It's difficult.
It's very tough. It's, you know, especially allowing yourself to meditate. Like, I'm not a big, you know, I can't say I've done it past the 2 days when I come back from each retreat, because like, you know, when it's in your mind and you're like, yes, I'm going to do it. I am now a meditative person. It doesn't last.
Making,
you know,
time for it. It's like with the book thing.
Yeah.
It's so annoying, but it's such a discipline. Like, I read books when I'm away, when I'm on a beach. And even when I'm on the beach, I like lying down and actually doing nothing, because it's so rare. Because at home, it's like, especially living in London, it's like the time is just going so quickly, where you could have been, you're trying to do as much as you can to like, well, I feel that anyway. I don't know if
yeah.
It's harder to chill here because it's like such a buzz and so quick.
And you know there's stuff going on and there's, you know.
Well, there's an urgency as well.
Yeah.
To everything.
Studio.
In
yeah. Enjoy. There's a writing session tomorrow. There's your friends doing this. So there's always something going
yeah.
on. Like, I'm the same with you. I always find, especially with reading, it has to be on like long plane journeys
mm-hmm.
or, you know, where I'm on a long train or something like that. And meditation wise, it's, you know, the points where I feel like I've properly meditated have been when I've gone on holiday and turned my phone off and
definitely,
haven't looked
yeah.
and I've just been around beautiful landscapes or in nature. And, you know, I may not be sat in silence trying to meditate, but for me, taking in the environment and being in my own world and kind of separate from, you know, what I think is normality, that's what I see as a bit of meditation for myself, you know.
I feel that. So that's the perfect time for the annual tradition. Annual? Can you call it annual? It's been five episodes. The annual tradition of piss break and then the shot that you might do. So it's fine.
Oh, I'm so happy. This is Chelsea's third of the day, peeps.
Third of the day.
Welcome back.
Well. Congratulations.
Well, welcome back after the tradition of the piss break to the Thanks for Trying podcast. But this was a piss break with a twist. As we can, Sinead, with eagle ears, heard the ice cream van from down the road. And her and our regular listeners to Thanks for Trying podcast will know our audience member, Chelsea, who's here every episode. They went and got 99 flakes, which, can you explain, they weren't 99p?
No, they're not 99p anymore. This was going to be 250. And I said, whoa.
Whoa. Oi, boss man.
Hold up,
boss man.
And then he said, oh, I'll do a kid's one for 150.
Yeah.
This looks no different to an adult one. But
no.
Yeah, so I think he just makes it up as he goes along. But anyway, we settled at £2.
And me and Mav were saying, what type of ice cream vendor is driving around the ends at... It's past dark now. It's like 9:30.
A gangster that clearly wants to make.
And he wasn't playing
bucks.
The full. he wasn't playing the full tune either. He was just teasing it like.
He's
about to, like he was about to drop into a little remix or something like.
What?
Yeah.
Whoa.
Well, as Sinead's driving, it's up to me and Mav to have the tradition of the shot.
Uh-huh. I've got the
tequila. She's
got
ice cream, so that's fine.
I've got the tequila.
So we've got the tequila, and it's for me to big up the sponsor of today, which is Monte Alban Mezcal. There's loads of fucking worms in it. I know we mentioned it earlier. They've got the agave worms. There's one worm in the bottle. We've decided we're all vegetarians, so we're not. That's our excuse.
We're going
to
pass on.
We're not going to eat the worm.
No worms were harmed.
Cheers. Thank you for coming.
Thank you.
I'll cheers you.
Thank you.
I'll cheers your ice
cheers.
Cream hand.
Cheers, guys.
All right.
Look in the eyes.
Oh, I was supposed to look. I was looking at the ice cream, sorry.
He's gone in. He didn't even look at the eyes.
I looked at you in the eyes when I did it.
Oh, okay.
That's right. Really
Woo!
Nice. That's really nice.
I didn't do the shot. I've got a little bit of a bitter lemon in mine.
And I'm the alcoholic at the table.
Yeah.
You look so content right now.
It's like the one... When it's sunny, we need these, isn't it, Chels? Chelsea's had three of these. This is on her third one right now.
She's had three today. Three ice creams in one. So wait, you've had
three ice creams in it?
Three 99s today.
No, magnums.
How much?
Magnums.
Oh.
Okay, she's had three magnums
what,
in one
almond?
Day.
Pink one.
Pink one? What flavor was that champagne?
What do the pink ones taste like?
Raspberry.
I'm not sure about that.
That's a weird combo.
Raspberry.
Okay.
I had a prototype Magnum the other week. Someone brought me one. It was like, she's like, yeah, we're testing a new flavor. I want you to try it out. It was like half melted. I was well into it. I don't even know what flavor it was. I was drunk. But.
Sorry, and who brought you this?
I can't hear that word without thinking of you are the prototype.
Andre 3000.
Mm, sick.
I heard his new tune with, I was a bit late on this, but on the Erykah Badu. Mixtape or EP.
Yeah.
He's got a little feature on that. It was wicked, no?
I haven't heard that.
It's just anything he touches is just, it's gold.
I love his tone, his flow. No one's been able to match it.
Exactly. And his peculiar imagery.
Yeah, yeah.
It always feels.
But it always makes sense as well at the same time.
Yeah. The bar, he, like, that verse was the verse of, 2014, I think, when he was on Rick Ross's 16. And 16 ain't enough. You know
one? Right.
And he just does this whole verse about him growing up and like his imagery is incredible. Mm. And he's a true artist that will never release a solo album. I'll put money on that. We'll never get a Three Stacks album. I mean, that's the dream. That's like top artist, I feel like. You know, if anyone I could collaborate with. Andre 3000, Tupac.
Of course.
Frank Sinatra. Andre 3000 again. Tupac again.
And repeating for it until, you know.
What, yeah. what was your first Tupac album that you rated? Because you said you're a Pac fan.
It was probably All Eyes on Me. Yeah. Which, you know, wasn't the first Pac album, but was the first one I sat down and listened to properly. And I got played, again, it's going to sound quite cliche, but I got played it in a shed in Ireland, yeah? Sick. In a shed, in the middle, like, in the countryside, in a shed, by a friend of mine's older brother. And he's like, Jesus, boy, you need to listen to this, Nolan. Tupac, Shakur, like, you need to listen to this. And I was like, what's this? And he puts it on, and honestly, it changed my life. Like, it changed my life from there, you know?
So made, like, the power, like... There was a while when, you know, going to record stores as a kid, you know, and all these like independent stores that would just, they would frown upon Tupac. But that's the whole reason I got into hip hop. I listened to Machiavelli first, and then I listened to All Eyes on Me, and that was it. I was like, I've got to make beats like DJ Quick.
Yeah.
I have to, or Daz, or Dre, or, you know, whoever, I have to. If it's the last thing I do, you know, and that's the whole reason I started making beats. But people would frown upon Tupac for so long. It's now, it's all right, but, you know, I couldn't go into one of these stores which are selling 12s and, you know, the people loving Madlib records.
Yeah,
and,
yeah, you know, yeah, yeah.
You know,
Tupac was almost seen in, like, the pop sense.
Yeah.
And not, but, you know what I mean? In a, like, especially in underground hip-hop world, it was, you know, there was always that little vibe of Tupac.
Mm.
It was funny, when I grew up in, a small town in Ireland, in a small town called New Ross, and... Even though, you know, we were very removed from hip-hop in general, but even in school, you know, when I was 14, 15, we were so into hip-hop that there was, you know, battles between students. Nah, Biggie's better.
Yeah.
What? Nah, Tupac's better, boy. And there was literally that divide of people who knew hip-hop. And this is a small town. And it just shows you, like we were speaking about again earlier on, how much hip-hop can really speak to people from, you know, completely different walks of life. But there's a... Especially with Tupac, you know. Yeah. I love Biggie, don't get me wrong. I love Biggie, but... With Tupac, with what he spoke about and how he spoke about it, he could speak about an experience that none of us have experienced, but there was things he said in it that would draw everyone in because you could attach yourself to certain feelings.
If you listen to Me Against the World, you can relate to you thinking everybody in that you got to fight everybody in the world. That everybody doesn't matter
back
who they
up
are.
Against the wall and not trusting people. You know, there was a common themes running throughout that I feel like a lot of people can connect with.
Yeah.
Oh.
Always rated Tupac. Were you a Tupac fan, Sinead?
Well, definitely, yeah. But I can't say that I know every album and every song word to word, word for word. I just appreciate the legacy that he left behind. And the thing about me is admittedly, I find rap music like a whole different experience to singers. Mm. I'm slow, so I have to listen to... Like, I've had to listen to Pimp a Butterfly literally over and over again since it came out before I could attach to
it. It's a grower album, though. Like,
yeah, and also before I could really understand, like, the essence of what he's saying. And then suddenly I'm hearing more... what's the word? More metaphors that I hadn't noticed the first time. And then when there's, like, double entendres and shit, and you're like... Oh, I didn't clock that at first.
Yeah.
So for me, I think because I'm a singer as well, I don't even have the capacity to come up with concepts that like, as at the speed that they do. Yeah. Therefore, I'm not gonna necessarily hear it first time. So, yes, I am a Tupac fan, but I need to educate myself more.
We were saying for us when we first both heard Tupac, we were, you know, it kind of definitely changed us, whether, you know, whether it's an island or Finsbury Park or wherever it was, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But what was the first record for as a singer that you heard and you went, you know what, that's changed my whole shit? Like
the first album, you know, I'd love to say something like Etta James, but actually Christina Aguilera introduced me to Etta James. Like, bearing in mind I was like 10, 11 when Christina blew, and that was the first time I've heard someone like make noises that I just feel something suddenly just by hearing a run that she did.
Crazy.
And obviously, like, it was a bit of a vocal acrobat at times to listen to, but that was soul. Like, she's got soul. We can't deny this. Yeah, she did Genie in a Bottle, but she also did
Banger.
Yeah, I know you get down to that in the shower. Oh, I can
the shower, getting dressed
every morning, every night before you go to sleep.
Yeah, that's it. Yeah. My wife's gonna walk down the aisle to that song.
Yeah, but then you know, later on album on Strip, she did songs like Walk Away and songs like I'm Okay about her dad. I got to see an artist, not just a pop star with a great voice. Like, so she introduced me to Etta James, and she was the first.
Because she bigs up Etta James. She did a couple songs with DJ Premier.
Ain't No Other Man.
Yeah, Ain't No Other Man.
For Back to Basics album.
That's the one. And she bigs up Etta James in a couple of those songs with Primo.
And then Lauryn Hill.
Yeah.
You know, when I heard Miss Education, and obviously I'd heard bits of the Fugees, which introduced me to her, and seeing Sister Act. I mean, if you want to watch that scene right now and cry, I'm sure you will. But it's just ridiculous. So, for me, the females resonate with me more, probably because I am female. and those two artists' albums.
Yeah. I mean, Miss Education was just...
Oof.
You know.
Yeah, despicable.
You could talk about perfect records. It was pretty... pretty close to being
and
impossible.
Leading on to my next one before I'm just going to indulge in this because Amy Frank who was inspired by Lauren herself so
and people forget James about Frank as well people,
Sarah Vaughan
people
Ella
overlook
Fitzgerald.
Frank I feel as well like the Amy fans of Back to Black and of everything you know Frank was that album was incredible
disgusting
that's how we started talking because we were talking about Salaam Remy his production on that you know. I remember seeing her live in Brighton.
What?
Yeah, in Brighton.
I'm so jealous.
Concord 2.
Oh, wow.
What did she sing? Was that Frank?
It was
times?
Frank, yeah. So Frank had just come out. It wasn't a very busy venue.
Have
like,
you seen
it
her
was,
AOL sessions?
Which ones
doing,
are the AOL?
Doing like You Sent Me Flying Live and stuff.
No, I don't think
she
I have.
Was just so sexy at this time at Frank. I mean, she's... always but you know she went
but that there she was so confident
just
her confidence just oozed
she was wearing this like yellow Adidas kind of like one you know kind of like tight dress but it looked like a Kill Bill kind of thing
right.
But it was sick and she looked incredible and when I go to gigs I don't always go to the front row I like to kind of like stand a bit to the back and so you know I get to just focus and absorb the music without dickheads you know whatever but this was the one gig I just stood at the front I had to stand it right at the front and like Amy Winehouse was probably one of the best performers I've ever seen in my entire life you know she was just incredible
I feel that something that maybe I don't see as often now is that like complete unashamed losing self to the emotion and moment in the, you know her performances are so unrehearsed and yeah, it's just like what she's left behind is ridiculous. Lyrically, it's like a masterpiece, every single song.
Yeah.
And again, back to the authenticity about it, she was just so raw. Just so raw with it. Like, even if it offended people, even if it offended her family or the men she was with or anything like that, she was just raw, really raw to the core. And,
definitely.
You know, her voice is, you know, a legacy within itself.
Definitely.
Let alone the songs and the lyrics that she wrote. She
was, you're right. The honesty in. What is it about men? It's all about her dad. And there's a live performance on YouTube still, and she's like, "This song's about my dad." And then like the audience are like, "Oh," and she goes, "No, it ain't cute. It ain't good. But I sorted it out now. But like, it was a bad time." And it's just that's real.
Yeah.
Did you ever meet her or like come across? You must have done.
Do you know what? I never came across her. No, never got the chance to. We had mutual friends, but. Yeah, never got the chance, which is, you know, I remember I released my first proper single on Mercury Records at the time. We were in I think it was Dermot O'Leary Live Lounge, and it got announced after we'd done like a live acoustic song. I did Ray Charles or something like that, and after I finished the song, everyone in the room went dead. Someone came in and whispered something. I thought I'd sworn or something.
Yeah.
I was really trying to tone down my swearing at the time. So I was thinking, what have I fucking done wrong here? Like, and everyone went just silent in the room. And then straight after, he was like, thank you very much. We've got something to announce. And literally announced it on air right there. And the whole building was just like, you know, I suppose I'm 25. So for me, Obviously, Michael Jackson, you know, died in my time that I can remember having a real impact on people. But as an artist that seemed quite similar age to me, and I brought up around the music quite heavily, it was, you know, first real impact that I felt like, wow, this is, you know, you can tell.
Because you were on the journey with her, like all of us were. She was our generation of singers.
I was inspired by her, you know what I mean? I was like literally directly inspired by her, you know, and inspired by her passion. You know, more so than there's not many singers, you know, from my generation that I've been inspired by as much as her. And it was like we were saying, it was the rawness of it was the passion of it that you rarely get to see, you know. And I would put her up there with, you know, all the classic singers that I've ever been inspired by from generations way before.
Because she had the pain.
She had pain, and that's
and the basis of. I mean, I kind of always saw her as jazz, like more than and jazz is pain. Like jazz is like, you know, I've been addicted to everything, and I am jazz. You know, like my flautist Biscuit, right? He's, you know, he's been through it all, and you can tell when he's on stage and when he's playing, because the way he's playing flute is like, you know, I mean, some people have seen him live, you know, that he is pain. He's everything he's playing, and that's what I saw from everything that Emmy did. You know, the one time I only met her briefly once, and it was at Pheromone's show,
at
Jazz Cafe,
right?
And I was at the top, you know, Jazz Cafe is a little bar at the top, and I was stood at the bar, and I was just like, you know, before Pharaoh came on, and this girl to the right of me shouted across to the girl to the left at me, and she's like, "Hey, Amy, what do you want?" And I turned around, and it's Amy sitting on us next to me. Wow. She goes, she just shouted, "Tequila!" That was it. Yes. And then we just stood next and watched the gig and all that stuff, and like, that's mad. Mm. Yeah, that was the brief, only ever moment. But she was there to watch Pharaoh.
Yeah.
Just as a fan.
And she seemed to be, from my knowledge of her, seemed to be a big hip-hop fan again.
Absolutely.
You know, I know she seemed to have a very close relationship with Nas and even more so Mos Def.
Yeah.
And that kind of, you know, came through in our music. You know, there was a Nas instrumental, a Salam Remy instrumental In My Room, was it?
In My Bed. Oh, the lyric
on
that.
Frank, and, you know...
Yeah.
I didn't think anyone could turn an instrumental like that into a soul jazz tune, and the lyrics in it just, it's a sad loss.
The only time I hold his hand is to get the angle right. Like, a nightingale no longer singing. Like, I don't know, it just baffles me. And she did have the pain.
Yeah.
I feel like everyone that I love has the pain.
Mm.
She had a way of communicating it that, so eloquently, and you were there with her.
Mm.
Like, I was just there in every song.
Mm-hmm.
It's crazy.
Yeah. I still haven't seen the film. I know.
Are you scared to? Have you been avoiding it?
A little bit. I mean, some of the documentaries that it took me a while to watch the Nina Simone one, because it's so real. And I'm not saying it's, you know, like, but we can all relate as musicians. We can all relate and watch something like that. Not to that, obviously, to that scale of addiction, but we all have our own addictions, and we all have our own, don't mean to rhyme, but afflictions, you know, of like, of just being, you know, of forcing ourselves and battling with ourselves, you know, with our creativity, and hating it and loving it, and needing to push alcohol or drugs down ourselves to kind of make us like love it again or hate it again, you know?
And to make us chill out for a sec from the obsession and the worry and the anxiety. But like, I always have this thing where if I talk about any of that to like my friends that don't do music, they're a bit like, what the fuck have you got to be sad about, you know? It's like, you're doing your dream, you love doing music. I'm in an office, or I'm a nanny and I hate it. Like, no, actually, none of the nannies hate, they love it, actually, they love the kids. But you know, and then I feel like a diva to ever complain. But it's I don't know, it's like something that we won't ever switch off from, but that we love and we don't want to switch off. But then the alcohol sometimes helps to switch off when it's getting too much.
And I think as creative people, part of being creative is being vulnerable, and to be that vulnerable and to be that emotionally willing to let yourself go comes hand in hand with being with ups and downs, you know, yeah. and loneliness and doubt and the utmost happiness and buzzes you get mm-hmm. when you're on stage, and then the drops when you come off tour and you're sat at home looking at four walls, you know what I mean, looking at a computer screen and trying to write your next song and trying to, there's ups and downs, you know what I mean, it's a roller coaster.
But also matching that feeling that you get, or that you, that we all get from going on stage and having people like adoring you, and then coming off stage and going, oh, I've got to do my washing, or I've got to do like real life, or I've got to, you know, do my taxes, or even just it's like this, it's a weird thing of trying to replicate that feeling every day when you don't have that feeling.
Yeah, and the music industry is a very peculiar world for people who are not in it, you know, and I suppose most people only see one side of the music industry, and I suppose creative industries all around, but just, we're in the music industry, so specifically the music industry, people do only really see one side of it, you know, and never get to see, you know, the downfalls or the hardships behind it. And so then may, in turn, never really understand why people, you know, battle with addictions or battle with other things while they go through that. Because, you know, while one side of your life is going crazy, and, you know, for example, like an Amy Winehouse, you know, maybe being exploited by the tabloids consistently through our life, there's personal issues that you have to deal with. At the same time, it's hard while there's something else going on that's so extreme like that, you know. And it can be very easy to judge on one side when you're not in it.
Yeah. Well, you know what? That's a perfect time to wrap up and say thank you very much to my guests of the Thanks for Trying podcast, episode 5. Maverick Sabre and Sinead Harnett, thank you very much for coming down.
Thank you for having us.
You have been listening to the Thanks for Trying podcast, episode 5. Hosted by myself, The Last Skeptic, with very, very special guests, Maverick Sabre and Sinead Harnett. Thank you so much to the guests for coming down. Thank you for listening. And thank you again to Monte Alban Mezcal for sponsoring this month's episode. The Thanks for Trying podcast will be back next month for episode 6. If you have suggestions on who you'd like to see guest on the Thanks for Trying podcast, then at me on Twitter, The Last Skeptic, let me know.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight, and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.